Blog Talk Radio.
They're here.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Tonight, the Movie Geeks celebrate the 25th year anniversary of one of the most beloved fright films of all time, Poltergeist, with writer-producer Michael Grace. Plus, reviews of the latest films, including Lions for Lambs, and this month's DVD releases, including special editions of Chinatown, The Two Jakes, and Ratatouille. Now, sit back, turn it up, and grab the popcorn. It's time to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for tonight's episode of Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Jerry, and Aaron.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. My name is Jamie, and Jerry's here with us. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, how's everyone doing?
And our home entertainment guru, Mr. Aaron Ata-Diaz, is here as well. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, what's up, fellas?
Great show for you tonight. I'm excited about this one. Anyone that knows anything about movies or has any passion for movies, Poltergeist is right up there. I mean, it's a landmark movie. So I'm sure you'll agree. Give me some agreement here, guys.
No disagreement at all.
Absolutely.
Summer of 82 is marked by, I think it was 1 week apart. It was E.T. then Poltergeist.
It was. I think it was like, if my memory serves, and honestly, I had to read this, but June 4th and then June 11th, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Huge summer.
That's one of the greatest summers on record.
Really defining summer. And that movie went a long way towards defining our childhood. I mean, if you're of the age group that we are, that was
I don't remember that summer in theaters, but I remember basically a year, 18 months later, when pretty much all those movies were on a loop on HBO.
Oh yeah.
Except for E.T. Remember E.T. was one of those.
Yeah.
But
Holy Grail videotape where everyone kept waiting for it to come out on tape.
Yeah. Right, that's very true.
So we're excited to get the show rolling tonight. Just a couple of notes. As always, I say this at the top of every show, but it's really important. Subscribe to our show through iTunes, would you? It's absolutely free, and you get the latest shows automatically downloaded into your system. Just click the subscribe to iTunes icon on the Blog Talk Radio page or search for Movie Geeks United on the iTunes search engine, and you'll find all of our great shows. You'll have those downloaded as well, including last Wednesday night show, which was a doozy. We interviewed director Brian De Palma.
It was our most important show.
It was really a phenomenal pleasure for all of us. We interviewed director Brian De Palma and the cast of his new film Redacted, and that's one that you really need to check out. It was a great one. This Wednesday night, the 14th at 10 p.m. Eastern, we're welcoming Oscar-nominated composer Mike Isham. Mark Isham. Sorry. Mark Isham to the
show. That's all right. That's okay.
I've been living with his music for the past couple of weeks. They sent me several of his latest releases, and it's just gorgeous. I'm in heaven listening to these CDs. And he composed Lions for Lambs, which we'll be discussing a little later in the show. Okay, let's get this thing started. In 1982, Poltergeist hit movie screens and managed to capture the imagination and tap into the deepest fears of audiences the world over. Now, 25 years later, this landmark film is still doing just that and introducing new generations of movie lovers to an experience elevated by both an intimate portrait of a regular suburban family and a grandiose rendering of the supernatural chaos that surrounds them. Michael Grace was called upon to script this legendary film, and he later went on to write and produce the first sequel as well, in a remarkably versatile career that has resulted in worldwide acclaim and gross revenues of more than $500 million. Mr. Grace has proven himself as a master of all genres. His additional credits include a variety of television work for classic shows like Kojak and Beretta, writing credits for films like Marked for Death and Cool World, and producing duties on terrific films like Great Balls of Fire, Sleepwalkers, and Who Killed Atlantis Children. It is a great pleasure to welcome to the show writer, producer, and director, Mr. Michael Grace. Mr. Grace, are you with us?
I'm with you.
thank you so much for calling in tonight and being a part of this. We're very excited to speak with you tonight.
I'm happy to be talking to you, too.
First of all,
happy to be talking to anybody.
Okay.
Yeah, you talked about how old you guys were when Poltergeist came out. I just want you to know, Stephen got me out of kindergarten to write this, and I was really honored.
Wow, you were quite a writer really early.
Yeah, I was. I was a prodigy.
Yeah.
More than a prodigy, that's for sure.
So tell me a little bit about how you broke into the business. I know you wrote for some pretty legendary television shows early on.
My first job was with Beretta.
Yeah.
And the way I got that job was I'd been in town for almost exactly a year, and I knew Beretta's assistant, and she got me a treatment for what they loosely called a approved story. Mm. So I was going to write a teleplay on spec for the show, just to show that I could write it. I read this treatment, and it was so bad that I wrote a 3 or 4 page synopsis of why it should never get made. It made its way to Robert Blake, Robert Blake, thought it was terrific.
Really?
I got a call, and the phone rang one night, and it was about 10 o'clock at night. I was sitting there drinking scotch, being a writer. Uh-huh. And they said, will you come down to the set at Universal? Mr. Blake wants to speak to you. And I thought, oh, God, I'm in trouble. So I went down there, got into his trailer. They ushered me into his trailer while he was finishing doing a scene. And he came in, and he sat down and says, I like what you wrote, kid. What do you want to do? So I said, well, I've never written an episode of a television series before, so I should probably start by rewriting. And he said, fine. You know, I'll have you rewriting by next week. And I left and thought, well, that's the last I'll hear of him, you know.
Right.
It was just a moment in time. But indeed, I got a call the following week and was called in to rewrite a show. And I spent a day and a half with the producers of the show and the director of that episode, and taking notes and discussing the script, et cetera. And then at the end of that, I asked the executive producer when they wanted it, and he said, tomorrow. So I wrote all night, and I write by longhand. I don't type, or don't work on a computer either.
Oh, you still work that way?
Yeah, I do.
Wow.
I just can't think when I'm staring at the screen.
Yeah.
So I wrote long, you know, on yellow legal pads the way I do now, and it came up, and it was the right number of pages, and they liked it. And so from that moment on, I was the rewrite guy over there.
Huh. You know, they say that, I've heard it said that television is the writer's medium. Do you find that to be true?
Yes, it is. The writer has more, I don't know if you want to call it power, whatever. Powers. I don't know, in Hollywood, I don't know, you know, when Sumner Redstone is calling Steven Spielberg inconsequential, you wonder what power is.
Mm.
So, but you do have more say over the words that you've written in television than you do in movies.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems that way. I've heard a lot of writers attest to that. So tell me how Spielberg came across your work and came to offer you the first of all, he offered you writing duties on his remake of A Guy Named Joe, which eventually became Always, right?
Yes, that's right.
How did that occur?
He read two scripts that me and my ex-partner had written. One was what turned into the movie called Death Hunt with Charles Bronson, Lee Marvin, Andrew Higgins.
Cool.
That's a wonderful movie.
Thank you, which was really kind of our ode to Jack London. And then he read another script that we wrote called Turn Left or Die, which was about air traffic controllers. It was a comedy, black comedy. And he thought, well, okay, now they can write this action kind of terrifying, you know, manhunt movie, and they can write this comedy, and I'll put that together and they can write a guy named Joe. So I went over to his house and he, you know, invited us over, and we went over there, and he screened a guy named Joe, and then he started, after we saw it, he started talking about this movie that he wanted to do, this scary movie that he wanted to do, this ghost story. And so the next day, we called him up and said, you know, we really love the fact that you're asking us to do this guy named Joe thing, but we really dig that story about the ghost. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know how people have ever done that with him.
Yeah.
But he said, okay, he says, I'm negotiating a deal with a writer that I don't think will work out, so let me finish that up and see how that goes, and then I'll get back to you. And he got back to us within, like, 48 hours and said, you guys got the job.
Oh, goodness. So what excited you about the prospect of doing this type of supernatural story?
Well, what really made it different than the other movies and the way he was speaking about it was that it was like Close Encounters. It was going to have a spiritual aspect to it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't going to, it was going to take place not on a haunted, in a haunted house, but in a, you know, suburban housing, you know, development. Just the, you know, that the ghost was going to come out of the television. That was about it. You know, that alone just completely intrigued us.
Mm.
So,
well, in the story point, because Spielberg gets story credit. So what were kind of, I'm just curious, what were kind of the initial key beats, or did he have like key, you know, elements or key sequences that this is something he had in his head from day one, and then y'all worked around it, or was it just ongoing process of like, you know?
It was an ongoing process. Pretty much what I told you was what he had in mind.
Really?
What he had on paper.
Yeah.
It was at that time. I think he called it nighttime, and the basic beats were that the ghosts would come out of the TV, that it would be set in a housing, you know, suburban housing thing. And it'd be a typical suburban Spielberg family.
Right.
So was it through research that or just the evolvingness of the writing that not only did the paranormal experts come in, but also the, you could say, the cleaner of the house, that the main, you know, in the second half when she comes in to clean the house, were those two things through research, or was that just, well, we need to bring experts in? How did that come about in the story? Cause that's a,
I
mean, that's
remember. I think the cleaners, I think, were was Stephen's idea, and then I think the little lady was, or the, you know, the psychic was my idea.
Okay.
Because I had been involved in that, just interested in that for a long time.
Yeah, obviously Spielberg, I would imagine, was very closely involved in every aspect of it, and that would include the writing phase, I'm sure.
Yes.
What kind of collaborator is Spielberg?
Interesting. he was doing E.T., as you guys were talking about.
Yeah.
So he didn't have a lot of time to spend on the script while we were doing it. He met us, we met in the cafeteria at MGM, like three times a week. He would have read what we wrote, and he'd give us notes on that. And then after we did the first draft, then he did a polish draft, and that was it. We were about to go on strike, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So we ended up picketing our own movie, which was an interesting experience as well. So there was no time to waste. And the other thing you were mentioning, that E.T. had, it was the summer of E.T., and Stephen thought that E.T. wasn't going to be successful.
Well, that turned out to be very wrong.
Oops. So he was really nervous about Poltergeist. You know, I mean, he's nervous that it was, he thought, well, this is a sure thing. But E.T., he says, I don't know what the audience is for that. You know, I just don't know. You know, I saw it, and I thought it was just fantastic, and it would be, you know, what it became.
So I'm curious, did he show you, like, you know, usually he'll show writers or people his, you know, what he's working on. So did he show you E.T. before, you know, it came out, and did you have an idea that it was going to be a hit, even though he was Concern?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, he showed it to us, and we told him, it's a monster. This is a monster hit. Yeah, this is going to get everybody. I mean, you know, everyone's going to have tears in their eyes and be laughing all at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. They talk about demographics and all of that. E.T. is basically for everyone who's breathing on the planet.
Yeah, it
covered all the bases.
Yeah.
You know, it was a terrific movie.
Now tell me about writing a film like Poltergeist. Is there a different discipline to an approach to writing a scary picture? And can you tell it's scary on the page? Because I know when it comes to comedies, I hear a lot of comedians say that if a script reads funny, then that's probably the death of the film.
Well, I had never written a horror script or a terror script, whatever you want to call it, before. And what I knew was that the characters worked, and what I knew was that the scares were scary, but on the page.
Right.
So, but I didn't see any of it being filmed at the premiere. They had a little screening before the premiere,
mm-hmm.
and I came a little late, and so I was in like the front row of a real small theater, and I started watching this movie. I ran out of the theater. I was scared.
Oh, it's frightening.
Well, the guy that wrote the film was frightened by it. Yeah.
Yeah, I was scared because I had never seen. You know, I didn't know about these special effects. I didn't know they were gonna be so good.
Yeah. Well, it did a number on me too. Don't worry.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we all got kind of zapped by that one. So.
So how you weren't close to the production phase of it at all?
No, we were. As I said, we were on strike. We were picketing. And so we were actually, Stephen was kind enough to send, when we were picketing MGM while they were shooting Poltergeist, Stephen was kind enough to send an assistant out to get us off the picket line so we could at least come in and see one set.
Yeah.
And it was cool because that was the set that Joe Beth got, you know, they've had her bedroom on a gimbal.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a thing that turns the bedroom upside down.
Right.
In that scene where the ghost pulls her around the room.
Mm.
So we saw that set and that scene being set up, and then we had to go back outside and pick it some more.
Well, I got a writer's question.
Sure.
Because Poltergeist has about, you know, has a few, I guess you could say, catchphrases, famous lines.
Yep.
So I'm just curious of where did they come from, or was it improv that when you saw the film, like, oh, okay, was that obviously they're here and don't go into the light? I mean, were those in the script? And
yes, they were in the script.
Did you know? Did you have any inkling that these might become like key lines that you know are quoted to this day?
No.
I mean, to the point that they're here became, I guess you could say, the advertising line for the sequel, which was they're back.
It's become pop culture.
It's become the lexicon of mm-hmm. Aaron.
Yeah, which became the advertising for everything from Chevrolets to
right.
whatever.
Yeah, and
he
really
uses that.
You really
I'm
can't
sorry?
Predict what'll catch on like that, can you?
No, you can't.
No one knows anything.
Yeah.
That's right. You don't know. You don't know what people are going to like or not like. In terms of a movie like Poltergeist, though, I mean, you have a built-in audience for terror.
Right.
And for action, you know, I mean, different thing, love stories, action.
So why do you think it survived as it has 25 years later?
I don't think it's unlike anything that's ever been done before, or I haven't seen anything like it since.
Yeah.
That mixes the elements of a real family with humor. We actually structured the first act to be comedic. I mean, if you just look at the first act and forget about what happens and the second and third act, it's a family comedy.
Yeah.
Oh, it is. You're right.
And,
absolutely.
And which completely disarms the audience. They're thinking, well, what, you know, what's this going to be? Well, it's Steven Spielberg. I guess it's going to be light.
When that tree scene sets in, though, it all changes.
But that's
yeah.
what's wonderful. You're talking about the first act of the movie. And that first segment, you really get invested in the family. As a family you really care for. And I think it's also a great touch that when the first phenomenons begin to occur, she's very excited and delighted by it.
Yeah, they think it's going to be, she thinks it's going to be mind expanding kind of
right.
thing. It's going to be happy. And it turns out, obviously,
not so happy.
I have an interesting story. That tree thing was kind of, it was brought into the script because something like that happened to me when I was a kid. Not that a tree came in and grabbed me, but when I was about, I don't know, 10, about a year before Stephen found me.
I love this guy.
I was left alone in my house. I grew up in Illinois, and I was left alone in the house while my parents were out, and then I took a nap or something, and I woke up, and my sisters weren't there, and no one was there, so they had gone out. And so I was just panicking, and there was a storm outside, and I'm sitting on the steps of my front steps of my house, not the outside, inside the stairway upstairs, and a tree limb comes smashing through the storm windows and the window. Mm. Well, there has never been a more frightened 11-year-old that you can
possibly imagine. Oh, I can imagine. Oh, my God.
That was, so when I told, we sat around and we talked about things that scared us when we were kids.
Right.
Those became the pieces. That became the scary pieces in the movie.
Well, I have a couple of questions for you about the Poltergeist 2, and then I want to hear what you're up to now. But when you're approached to do the sequel, were you at all apprehensive?
No, not at all. No, I wasn't apprehensive at all.
Well, that answers that question.
No, I was excited to do it. But basically, I said, well, knowing how much they wanted it, and they wanted us to do it, and Stephen kind of gave us the stamp of approval to do it. He said, well, if you want us to do it, we want to produce it. And they said, okay, well, if you're going to produce it, you're going to suffer on this deal. Which is, fair enough. Okay, we're giving you the possibility of a career boost, entering a new career with a big movie.
Right.
So we'll take it out of your hide kind of thing. So we learned. It was great.
What kind of ideas were you trying to mine with that sequel?
First we had to talk the cast into coming back. They weren't signed to do the sequel. So we had to go around and talk Joe Beth and Craig, who had, they had careers going.
Yeah.
From the success of Poltergeist. And they, at that time, sequels weren't a big, weren't hot on anyone's list of things to do, in terms of, they didn't make the kind of money that they make now, where it seems like the sequels make more money than the original.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At that time, that wasn't true, and so we had to do some real, maneuvering in terms of blending the script to what they were interested in at the time, what was going through their minds.
Yeah.
So it came about through discussions with Craig and Joe Beth, and one of those discussions was Craig had been living up in Mount Shasta and had met an old Indian shaman, and he was just telling us stories about the shaman and how fascinated he was with this guy, and so that became a major part of the film.
Hmm.
And Joe Beth had her. Her grandmother, I think, had just passed away, and so she was kind of still grieving for that. And so we had that death of her mother,
right?
And so that when we told them, we fed the story. Once we'd come up with the story, fed it back to them, and had incorporated these elements into it. They were very excited about doing it, and then they joined on. They came on.
Mm, I got two questions for you about Poltergeist 2.
Sure.
First of all, the concept of the character of Kane, brilliantly played by Julian Beck, and his importance as an actor cannot be understated. He began the Living Theater, and that was a very influential group, and he was a very influential figure in the acting community. But I heard that the concept of that character was originally drawn as a Jim Jones type?
Yes, that's right. Jim Jones was the... We figured we'll do a Jim Jones from the past,
right.
From the original Jim Jones. But yeah, that had just happened not so long before Poltergeist 2, and it was fresh in everyone's mind, the horror of that.
Yeah.
So that's what we did, and another interesting thing about Julian was he wasn't insurable because he was ill.
Right.
And we wanted him so bad, and the director wanted him so bad, that we said, well, we'll put up our salaries for his insurance.
Oh, wow.
And so that was the last thing that he ever did.
Yeah. And he one of the best things about that film, which is absolutely spooky, and just a great performance that he gave. The second thing I had to ask about Poltergeist 2, where in the hell did you get the idea for that worm?
Well, having drunk a lot of tequila myself, I knew what it did to me. So so that's how it got in the film, actually.
That was an H.R. Geiger. Didn't he do the worm?
Yeah, H.R. Giger did the worm, and we had a Vietnam vet named Noble Craig, who was the when the worm grew and became that hideous thing under the bed.
The vomit creature.
Yeah, that was a gentleman who had one arm and no legs and fit into this suit that we, you know, that was created by HR for him. And this guy was unbelievable. You know, he was such a bright spirit. And if you ever thought of feeling sorry for this guy, his wife and baby came to the set, mm-hmm. and she looked like Marilyn Monroe.
Oh my God.
So, you know, there was no more feeling sorry for him after that.
Now, can you speak to this so-called poltergeist curse? Do you put much stock into that whole theory?
No, I don't. Julian was really dying when we hired him. I mean, he was sick, and what's his name? Wills was had. He had lung disease from working in the mines.
Mm.
So he was, you know, that was his Achilles heel. And he did, I don't know, two or three movies after that.
Yeah.
And the little girl had, the little girl, not the girl that died in the first movie, which was just, all of it was tragic.
Yeah.
I mean, the little kids dying was tragic. The first girl, I don't know anyone get it.
Heather O'Rourke, yeah.
Yeah, Heather O'Rourke. But
I heard that the set of that second film was a little eerie. I think Will Sampson at one point performed a ritual on the set. Or...
Yeah, that was really interesting. We had the underground cave that Kane was exhorting his people to, you know, basically drink the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
And we had brought in all these skeletons, and we thought they were all plastic, but it turned out that some of them were skeletons.
Oh, God.
So I was sitting next. Will was sitting there while we were watching people slide off this mountain. You know, that was on the set. And literally, the camera slid off the off the mountain at one point.
Hmm.
We couldn't shoot, and Will is just sitting there, kind of like So I looked over at him and said, this guy knows. So I went and sat down next to him. I said, Will, what's going on? He goes, skeleton's not happy.
Uh-oh.
I said, really? I said, is there anything you could do about it? He goes, yeah, leave the door open for me tonight. Tell the guard at the gate to let me in, and I'll take care of it.
Huh.
And the next, he came in that night, and the next day, everything was fine.
Wow.
So...
I guess, like, he sounds almost like someone who works for the mafia. Like, I'll take care of it.
Yeah, I know. He was kind of like the shaman, I'll take care of it guy.
Yeah.
He was a shaman for three different tribes.
So what is this news I see that there's another poltergeist in development that you're attached to?
I don't know where this... I wrote a treatment for a, you know, what could become a poltergeist three movie, and it just kind of caught on that all these people think that I'm doing it, but MGM hasn't hired me to write it, so I don't, you know, I don't know what's with it.
So there's you don't know the status of it at all, or it's just
no.
Okay.
I really don't, and you know.
Well, yeah. you have some. I want to ask about one other past film that you produced, and it's
sure.
a film that I've always really liked. It's kind of my underrated treasures. And that's Great Balls of Fire.
Oh, yes. I was going to bring that
film.
Up.
Yeah, I love that movie. It's so much fun. Tell me about your experiences on that film. What comes to mind?
Well, I met Dennis Quaid a few months ago in a restaurant in L.A. We were talking to him about doing something else. And the other guys, the other people involved were sitting at the table, and I came in. Again, late, and was walking up, and he looks at me, and he's squinting at me, and he's going, who is that guy? And he says, I know you from somewhere. I said, Great Balls of Fire. And he just, like, ducked his head and said, wasn't one of my best days.
Oh, really?
he had taken on, he was a character actor, and he just got drunk and stayed drunk, a bit like Jerry Lee, you know, I mean, Jerry Lee was one of the scariest guys I'd ever met.
Right.
And Dennis was right up there with him during the shooting.
Now, I read a rumor, and I read this so long ago, and it was just in passing, but I read that Terrence Malick did some work on that film.
Yeah, Terrence Malick did what the film that we envisioned, which was basically the Raging Bull of rock and roll.
Yeah.
And he did a terrific script, but the studio didn't want to shoot that script.
Goodness! Well,
yeah.
Well. For the record, I know it's a film that's blasted here and there, but I love it. I've always had a great time with it.
I think I understand. I know how it through development it kind of got some would say watered down, but I think as it is now, it almost plays like the spirit of those actual 1950s juvenile delinquent rock and roll music.
Right, that's a good
and
point.
And on that level, I think it's a lot of fun.
I like it more now than I did then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's really a joy to watch.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I thought, you know what, I really like Terrence's version better.
Right.
But
So let's talk about something new that you've written. I saw it in Variety magazine. They announced the project that you're writing and producing. I believe it's called Home Before Daylight.
Yeah, Steve Parrish was the roadie for The Grateful Dead for 35 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
He wrote the novel, his memoirs, Home Before Daylight, and I'm doing the adaptation and writing and producing it, yeah.
So how much has the Grateful Dead meant to you throughout your life, and how exciting is it to get this project off the ground as a fan? I take it...
When I was at NYU, I was also working at the Fillmore East, and so I heard all the great bands. And it was one of the things that bonded Steve and I together was he was there a night backstage where I was out front being an usher telling people to put out their marijuana cigarettes.
Right.
And what I remember about that night was the Grateful Dead played the entire night. They played until dawn.
Mm.
They also dosed the water with LSD. So there were a lot of employees. We're not at their best. We're not in the best shape that night. But I kind of like their improvisational style.
Yeah,
I liked. It was kind of like the jazz of rock and roll.
Yeah, it really was.
Right. Really, it was interesting. You know, it was different than anything else that was going on. And certainly the people that were following them, and the pop culture that surrounded them, was different than anything I had seen either. And
yeah.
I had been around all the groups, and you know, The Who, Jimi Hendrix, The Doors, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the Grateful Dead had a more bizarre and interestingly bizarre group of people around them than anyone did.
Yeah. So I know you also recently directed your own short film called Lakeshore Drive.
Right.
How did you take to directing? Is it something you want to return to again?
No. I think after directing that, I realized that I'd rather not to be a director. I really enjoyed the process. It was good. It was a good experience. But, you know, I just think that there's people who are better at it than I am, and I'd rather have them do it.
Right.
I also am doing a project based on Tim McGraw's hit song, Live Like You Were Dying, for Daybreak Productions, Chuck Gordon's company.
Yeah, is that you're adapting a film from a song, essentially? Or?
I wrote a story inspired by the song.
Right.
And I'm going to write the screenplay of that.
Oh, wow. Well, you have some exciting projects coming up, and we're looking forward to all of them. And we can't thank you enough for spending this much time with us tonight.
Oh, it's a joy. You guys are great.
It's been a great
pleasure.
Love the show. Thank you so much, Mr. Grace, for joining us.
Sure.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
That is Michael Grace, the writer of Poltergeist, the writer-producer of Poltergeist 2. A great, great guest. Yeah.
I thought so. I'm just...
You guys can join in and agree here.
No, it's a lot of fun. I just wish there the way I could. I wish I could read the Terrence Malick "Great Balls of Fire" script.
Yeah, that's one of those. That's one of those projects, you know, those big mystery projects. But
the thing about "Great Balls of Fire" for me, because I was 10 going on 11 when it came out, the great summer of '89, and I remember being 11 and. You know, it wasn't until later that I realized, you know, obviously the film kind of glossed over Jerry Lee Lewis's dark stuff. But if anything, it was the right film at the right time for a kid to get into old music.
Right.
And I remember I became a big Jerry Lee Lewis fan. And I just, you know, I just gobbled up everything I could get my hands on back in 89.
Yeah,
that's right.
I thought it was a great, great fun movie. But Poltergeist essentially did... For a while, did for the TV set what Jaws did for the water, don't you think?
Oh yeah.
Well, what it did, not so much more than TV. I think for my family, that whole when the station goes off the air and they play the national anthem.
Yeah.
I think that was that's what's kind of interesting. They don't, you know, that does not happen anymore.
Yeah.
No, not at all. I mean, it's an alien concept. If you bring it up to kids today, they look at you like, "What are you talking about?"
And for some, I remember.
TV went off at midnight? That is a scary world.
Yeah.
That's like the ultimate horror movie for me.
That is. That would be.
And I would get spooked when, you know, the national anthem would start and then it would go to snow. Now if a station goes off the air for an hour, it's just the color bars, which are...
It's an infomercial.
Or infomercial.
Yeah, it's the infomercial.
And they can be, those can be scarier.
Yeah. So a great film. And we appreciate Mr. Grace calling in. A great conversation.
That was a great conversation. I forgot about the writer's strike back then.
Yeah, I mean, that was the last... Well, this was 82, and I think the last big one was 88.
88. 82 was kind of a... It was one of those... It started up, and then I think it got quickly, you know, negotiated, but then 88 was that big one. I always... The thing I always hear about the 88 one, that, like... If you listen to the online geeks, the big fallout of the 88 strike is that they didn't get to use the really good script for the Tim Burton Batman. Like, that's always been like the rumor. The Sam Hamm script for Batman is like supposed to be amazing, but because of the strike, they weren't able to fully use it.
Well, Burton would have found a way to compromise the script.
I think we just lost Tim Burton as a guest.
I don't think his strength was...
Oh, come on, dude. Tim Burton is a visionary.
He is a visionary.
I don't want to even hear anything bad about Tim Burton.
No,
Not while I'm on the air. If I'm not on the show, go ahead and bash him. But while
I wasn't talking about his vision. I mean, his vision is exceptional. He just doesn't have very good storytelling.
I don't know about that. I'm
not going to bash Tim Burton, but I will say every director has their...
strengths and weaknesses.
And Tim Burton happens to be Planet of the Apes.
That's the one film I would say that I would never... I don't know why he went ahead and did that, but otherwise, I don't really have any complaints.
Right. Okay. Well, let's get to something that you do have some complaints about, Jerry.
Well, I don't know if I have complaints. I don't know.
Well, let me introduce what the topic is first.
I know what this topic is.
Well, but our listeners don't. So let me say, Lions for Lambs,
okay.
All three of us saw it this weekend, and we all have varying takes on the film.
Yeah.
Strengths and weaknesses. So, Jerry, why don't you start off by telling us what you thought of the film?
Well, I think I give the film an A for effort. I really do. I really, of all the directors who could pull this off, Robert Redford is the one I would trust to do it. I don't know what you want me to say after that, though, because I think after writing about it all day and talking about it all weekend, I think if I haven't... Here's the thing. I will say this. The film, if you do not keep up with current events, if you do not read a daily newspaper, you should watch this film. I think that's the most important thing I can say about it. If you're in college and you don't keep up with current events, please do yourself a favor and go see this film. If you do keep up with current events and you do read a daily paper, the film is going to seem dated to you as soon as you watch it.
What about it dates it?
It's just what we were talking about a month ago or 2 months ago. It's impossible to keep up with this narrative. I do like the film, though, for one particular reason. It is a huge indictment of the Fourth Estate, of the media. It is a very, I think Robert Redford felt probably betrayed because he had played Woodward and done such a great job of playing Bob Woodward in All the President's Men. He must have, like many of us, felt betrayed when Bob Woodward all of a sudden became a mouthpiece for the Bush administration for the first 6 years and really didn't change his tune. I mean, he was basically quoted among many of his peers that Woodward had become the stenographer for the Bush White House.
Right.
And you're talking
about how that's reflected in the relationship between Tom Cruise, who plays a Republican senator, who essentially brings in a reporter to sell his new plan for the Afghanistan war, for victory in Afghanistan.
That's right.
And her, he's counting on her willingness to play along.
And I think to the strength, that is the film's strongest storyline is between Tom Cruise and Meryl Streep. And I think Tom Cruise is electric in this film. He's superb.
He's fantastic. Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't, a lot of people like to, bash Cruise and everything, but no, he is, as far as performances go, his film is worth watching the film. I mean, it's just, he's incredible in the film. When he plays against type, he does it so well, and people don't give him enough credit. But when he does, he is electrifying.
Yeah, he's, just to say something about Tom Cruise before, Aaron, you share your views on the film. He's known as a very hard worker. Tom Cruise works really hard at putting together performance. I think that a lot of times that effort shows. I think in Lions for Lambs, it feels, for the most part, very effortless.
Yes.
Maybe for the first time, because a lot of his effort does show, and I don't think he has the natural ability of the legends that he's worked with in the past, Dustin Hoffman or Gene Hackman, but I think he's learned so much from them.
Oh, I think that's a very good point. That's a very good point. I think this scene, there's a part in the film when the Meryl Streep character, when Jeanine Roth says something like we didn't go along with it. And he looks at her and goes, "No, you're right there with us. You sold this with us." And it's just brilliant.
Yeah. Aaron, what were your thoughts on the film?
Well, not to start a...
Come on, let's start a war. Come on.
Start a war, Aaron.
But I got to disagree with Jerry on every single point. I agree about Tom Cruise. I think he's obviously a great movie star, but I've always thought he's truly an underrated actor. His strength, when he does the movie star thing, he's one of the best. But when he does the movie star type roles and then allows for cracks in the veneer, he's even more excited. I'm talking like Jerry Maguire or Rain Man or Magnolia is amazing.
Oh, Magnolia especially.
Magnolia, Vanilla Sky. Vanilla Sky performance is almost a deconstruction of the Tom Cruise image. That's pretty interesting to just study. Yeah. But as for Lions, I got to disagree with Jerry in that I think if you haven't read a paper, you're not going to be able to keep up with this film. I think this film is for the informed.
I just don't see it.
Because they're using shorthand and referencing things that if you're not aware of by reading the paper, there's no way you can kind of... This film pretty much assumes that you kind of know what's going on in the world. It's similar. While this is not in the same league as the film, but its topicality and its intensity is similar. It's similar to the movie Oliver Stone's Nixon, which is still probably the greatest political film in American film history. And like Nixon, if you didn't know your history, you weren't going to be able to follow along. But the other thing, I do think obviously Redford, you know, because he played Woodward and he did the great and most influential probably journalist film next to Citizen Kane, being All the President's Men. I'm sure he felt kind of disillusioned, but I think he got over his anger and he says, okay, I'm angry, but I don't want to make an angry polemic. I want to have an actual discussion. And mm-hmm. I have said this since I seen the film 2 days ago, and I feel stronger every time I think about it, that if you are a liberal and you go to the film, you're going to get your point of view out of the film. But I also truly believe that if you are a conservative or a Republican or whatever, and you go to the film, you're going to feel that the film is pretty much understands your take of the situation.
Oh, that's true. No one's debating that.
I thought it was surprisingly balanced.
It is surprisingly
balanced. To the point where I feel that it's so balanced and it's so panders to both sides that it's almost meaningless towards the end.
I don't think it panders because there's no, at this point, I mean, at this point, majority of people don't like the war. There's no need to pander to that. So let's try to have a discussion about it and see if we can come up with some solution. And I think the Meryl Streep character is interesting because, yes, Cruz is a good salesman as this senator, Senator Irving, and she almost buys it. But her reporter instincts kick in, and when she gets back to her editor...
Oh, yeah, she's disillusioned. She's full of anguish.
Well, the key is that she almost bought what he was selling, but when she was in, she's in his office, and she understands that this phone call happened, but she has no idea what this phone call is about. She goes back to her editor, brilliantly played by Kevin Dunn in one scene, one great scene, and she starts to realize how this selling did occur to the news media. But then, even though now that she's aware of this, Kevin Dunn points out brilliantly in his performance that, okay, but there's nothing, you don't have any proof, and so we have to go with what you have. And so that, I think, is kind of the quandary that... the media, particularly broadcast media, finds itself in. So the Kevin Dunn performance, he's in one scene, is pretty layered for being, he starts off being your typical blowhard news producer, but he has his own doubts and his own questions. There's not a stock performance in this whole thing. Even Peter Berg as this gung-ho commander is pretty remarkable.
Yeah. This is why I think... it's important to know something about this current situation before you see the movie, is because the movie's theme, to me, seems to be expressed in something that Redford says, and that is, you know, you have an opinion on the war, you know how you feel about it, now what are you going to do about it? You know,
right.
Are you going to take action?
Right, that he spells it out pretty, in that one scene, he says that pretty clearly.
Yeah, and I think it's a film of ideas. I think it's a lot more accessibly patriotic than something like Redacted.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But I think it really paints our soldiers as heroes and not just thoughtless guys that go over there for no reason. Guys that, you know, have a purpose and feel a duty to go over there and serve their country.
We should mention these actors named Michael Pena, who was in Babel, and
yeah.
Who was terrific in World Trade Center. And Derek Luke, who started off and, you know, got his break with Antoine Fisher, but
right.
Has done other stuff. He was terrific in Spartan. And these two guys give great performances.
I think they're underwritten.
Yeah. I don't think they are.
I don't think they get enough. Their story is so extraordinary, Aaron, that I think when it is their time to shine, that he doesn't do anything with them. I would have loved another half hour.
Well, I mean,
to explore this, because I don't think it works, their story.
I think that's kind of debatable, because what I admire about the film is that it's able to pack all this information and these ideas in a 90-minute runtime, and it's pretty remarkable, and it's pretty much done almost in real time. But we get a couple of the two flashbacks we get with these guys when they're having dinner with...
I think they have two major scenes.
When they're having dinner with Redford, and they're debating of going, and then their presentation to their class, because, and they are the two kind of, they stick out, they're the two real big minorities in the class.
Well, they're the only minorities. I think everyone else is white, and except for that one guy, everyone else, the majority is white.
Yeah. And so those two scenes have to have real weight, and I think they have real weight, and they carry enough not only character nuance but also just political information and insight that I think you get basically their character life background from those two scenes and from the way Redford talks about them. And so I think you do get enough, and then the way that they communicate when they're out there in the snow and they're injured and they're trying to help each other, you get a real sense of brotherly connection. So I think you do get enough. I want to say one thing, because we're talking about this film in political ideas and it's a lot of talk and the kind of a king repeat, but I also want to say that Redford doesn't get enough credit, even though he has won an Oscar, he doesn't get enough credit for being a very cinematic filmmaker. And I think, and I'm a huge Ordinary People fan, and Quiz Show, I think, is one of the best films about the 50s. But Lions for Lands has some of the most precise editing of the year. And what I mean by that is that a question will be asked by a character or a statement will be made, and the next shot is almost a answer to that question or statement. There, an obvious one is Peter Berg says, I want to meet the motherfucker who gave us the Zintel, and it automatically cuts to Tom Cruise.
Right.
So that
gets
kind of a knowing laugh in the audience. But another great scene that I think is really interesting, Redford asked his students, he goes, you know, you're so apathetic. And he goes, what do you plan on doing? And he doesn't say anything. And the next scene is Tom Cruise, as if this kid is a different version of what the Tom Cruise character could have been.
Do you think that Todd would become the Tom?
He could. It's suggesting that he could either become the Tom Cruise character, or he
could become the other frat brothers too.
Right, and so that I think is pretty remarkable.
I don't. I mean, I understand where you're coming from with the editing, but I just there. I don't agree with you guys that I don't think. I think it is. I think if you walked into this film cold, if you were just playing like Halo for your whole life and walked into this film cold, I think this is kind of an informative film. If you were like Todd, if you're Todd, there are two targets that Redford's aiming for, the media and Todd's generation, the college student.
Right.
And those are the two things he's attacking and addressing in this film. So those are the two audiences. And I don't know why he's addressing college students, because they're not, you know, this is an adult-themed drama, and they're not rushing the
Well, it goes back to what we said with Redacted. I mean,
yeah.
College students, the protests that occurred in the college campuses during Vietnam, I mean, the college students really were
that
the ones
that... That is something I do admire about the film also, because it does invoke Vietnam.
Oh, it's the elephant in the room.
A couple of times. But I will say, this is one of the rare films where we get this generation gap going, and the invoking of Vietnam is not eyeball-rolling-inducing. There actually is something at stake when they invoke Vietnam. It's not lorded over someone like Todd. Am I saying
no? He doesn't. Malley doesn't lord it over at all. Malley almost. I think Malley is a. You know, Malley's anguish in the film, because he feels so guilty about Arian and Ernest.
Right.
And that's there from the. I mean, the anguish is there once we realize what he's done. It's there from the first time we see Robert Redford till the end of the film, that he feels this incredible sense of guilt. And he's the theme of the film, really, and it is the theme of the last, probably from Vietnam on, is about history repeating itself. And history repeats itself in each story. You know, will Meryl Streep once again, will her character, will the press once again, really for the third time, be, you know, allow this, you know, war? Will they sell a war again that there's no factual information, there's no facts, it's just, you know, selling the administration line? Will Robert Redford, will he allow another student to make the same mistake?
And you were talking about how you think the film might be dated. I was actually kind of startled, because obviously this film was, you know, made, you know, 8-10 months ago. I was actually startled because I think this is the first political film that actually mentions Iran in this battle.
In this battle, but the thing that he mentions about the Sunnis and the Shia working together. I mean, I nearly yelled out you know, yelled at my feet. I'm like, oh my God, you, because I don't know how factual it is, but the reason I say it's dated, Aaron, the reason I say it's dated is not a fault to the film, and I think both of you need to hear this. It's not a fault of the filmmakers. When I say it's dated, I am saying the narrative, the war on terror, but say that the September 12th era of 2001 has constantly changed. It is not, I am not putting fault on Redford or anyone who wrote the film. I am saying when you wake up on last Saturday morning, you hear that Musharraf has declared a state of emergency in Pakistan. The stakes of this whole thing have changed dramatically. It's hard for me to watch this film. Very hard. Maddening almost. I'm ripping my hair out at times.
Okay.
Let me finish, because I know you don't like to bring in politics to this, but when talking about this kind of film on Redacted, you have to. With this thing in Pakistan has changed everything.
I mean, I do agree that the film does have a very limited shelf life.
Yeah.
You know, 10 years from now, when they do the Redford retrospective and they show this film, it's going to be looked as a time capsule snapshot.
I don't think it will. I mean, I just don't.
It's his best film since Quiz Show. It's his most engaging film since Quiz Show.
You know, and All the President's Men, Watergate is dated, but the issues it represents
are as timely as ever.
That is true. But I do want to make this one more point, because
we
talked to a screenwriter, and I think we should always highlight screenwriters when possible. Matthew Michael Carnahan, the guy that wrote the screenplay, this is his second script in 2 months, basically, where he does political, he tackles political topics, but he seems to be, what I find amazing about this guy, and that's why I'm anxious about his next film, whatever it happens to be, is that he's interested in politics, but he's interested in exploring politics in different genres. Here we get a kind of somber chamber piece, which I think is very exciting. It's ironic that a film like Lions for Lambs can be considered exciting in this day and age, when in, you know, from about 67 to 77, these were almost a dime a dozen.
Right.
Also, I like the fact that I was actually a fan of The Kingdom, and
absolutely,
he did political topicality, and he put it into kind of a kick-ass action film. So I'm excited that he is exploring politics in different genres.
Yeah, he's a great up-and-coming writer.
Yeah, he is. And The Kingdom, you know, basically this, if you wanted to sum up The Kingdom, he basically says you send the FBI, an FBI team over,
yeah,
to fight the guys who did this to us.
I'd almost think he has more talent. He might have more talent than his brother.
That's a very good argument.
Okay, that'll be another showdown.
Okay.
For another,
we just lost Joe Carnahan as a guest also. Just,
no, we'll get Joe.
We'll get
Joe for White Jazz.
Okay, it's time for our home video spotlight. We have several films to discuss tonight that have just come out on video or are on their way to a video release. And let's start out, Aaron.
Let's start out with the 1-2 punch. That way we can kill two birds with one stone of Chinatown and Two Jakes.
That's right. Chinatown, Roman Polanski's film, and Two Jakes, the one that Nicholson directed, a sequel of sorts to.
We've been all over the map here opinion-wise, but I'm assuming we all can agree that Chinatown is one of the great films of the 70s. Am I correct?
Oh, not of the 70s, of the 20th century.
Okay. Okay, well, I don't want to overstep, but okay. We can all agree Chinatown is a masterpiece, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so there'll be no arguments here.
Yeah.
Two Jake, we might have an argument, but we'll get to that in a second.
I liked it.
So Chinatown, it was one of the, it had been released on DVD earlier, when DVD format was still new, I think, like in maybe 99 or 2000 or 01, one of these. And it had a couple little tidbits and interviews and a decent transfer, but finally it's Paramount. And we said this on our DVD show, that if Warner Brothers and Criterion are the gold standard of DVD presentation, Paramount is probably towards the bottom, unless it happens to be Star Trek or Friday the 13th box set. They really kind of just throw out their DVDs with a couple little bells and whistles. Unless a director really demands to put time and energy in it, like I guess David Fincher did with Zodiac, which will be coming up.
Right.
You know, Paramount really doesn't put much stock in their DVDs. But as we also learned on our DVD show, that Paramount now has kind of made a deal with Criterion. and they've, you know, Days of Heaven has come out. So hopefully we'll finally get some good stuff. So here they've corrected a slight wrong by actually doing about an hour's worth of featurettes, three featurettes. It could have been one long documentary, but I've been reading this where they break it up almost purposely because apparently it costs, they have to pay more the longer the documentary is, something about fees. I don't know what it is. So they've broken up this basically an hour documentary into three parts, and it's pretty remarkable. I think the most remarkable thing in it is that they got Roman Polanski to talk on camera. And I think that's very exciting.
Well, he's very proud of Chinatown. He even
says
it outside of. He even says that outside of The Pianist, which is his favorite movie of his own. He would have to see Chinatown as the second.
It should be noted that Faye Dunaway still obviously must be pissed about her experience, because, I mean, let's face it, Robert Evans, Roman Polanski, and Jack Nicholson on one set, and Faye Dunaway, the only woman on the set, it's had been a lot of tension.
True.
And they speak to that.
Yeah.
In the documentaries, they speak to that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear a clip from Chinatown. You guys ready?
Oh, yes.
Let's hear it.
She's my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister. She's my daughter. My sister, my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
No! She's my sister and my daughter.
That's the clip to play.
Yeah, that is.
You know, 1974, if I remember, I don't remember who won Best Actress. Obviously, it wasn't Faye Dunaway, and that was also the year of Gina Rowlands for Woman Under the Influence. But I neither one of them won, if I remember correctly. But I will state, as often as I've seen Chinatown, Faye Dunaway's performance is probably one of the greatest performances by an actress in cinema history, because it works on two levels, in that she has to play it as someone who's hiding a secret but never lets on that she's hiding a secret. And also, she has to play it to where we don't, when we go back and rewatch the film, that we can see little hints now that we didn't see the first time.
Yeah.
And so it's a multi-layered performance that is just remarkable.
Yeah, it's a timeless movie. It really is.
Yeah.
And one that wasn't automatically well received in script form. They thought it was brilliant, but part of them thought that, what the hell is this movie about?
Yeah, that was considered, it's still considered one of the greatest screenplays ever written.
Well, I remember when Siskel and Ebert, they did one of their best shows on the golden age of Hollywood. They did of the early 70s, and they covered the year 70 to 74. And they picked a title each from each year. And I remember, I think it was Ebert had picked Chinatown. And he talked about, and this was in 93 when the show aired. And I remember when they were discussing it, he said, I think if the script came in today, the first thing they would say, well, we like the script, but could it be something a little sexier than water, like drugs? You know, that's a little more mainstream.
Right.
I mean, it's an odd film to see that it's a film about the, you know, corruption being fought over water, of all things.
It's a quintessential California L.A. piece. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Looking at Chinatown just again recently, you know, with this DVD, I had to smile a few times because I had heard about it and I had thought about it when I saw it, but I truly do it comes into focus now how much Who Framed Roger Rabbit is kind of a takeoff on Chinatown.
That's true.
Where instead of water, now it's, you know, Cartoonville or whatever.
You know, something else I want to mention, it's the bravery of the times. Aaron, you're talking about what kind of changes they would make. I think the most important change that they would make, they would not under any circumstances let Jack Nicholson, the main star of the movie, be featured with a bandage over his nose and face for more than half the movie.
Yeah.
You know, that's one thing right there.
Yeah.
I think it's just a classic movie that works. So, Aaron, would you recommend this disc or no?
Oh, you got to own Chinatown.
Right.
You got to own Chinatown no matter what. But finally, it's a good enough presentation with some fairly informative documentaries that it's worthy that you finally have a good edition of Chinatown.
Right.
I would. So you would recommend it?
I would recommend. I think it's a terrific film.
I would recommend it if you do not have the prior incarnation of Chinatown on TV.
Yeah, I have the prior one. So is it worth double dipping there?
I would still recommend this, but you don't have to race out.
Yeah.
I can take a couple days.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Eventually, you'll want it because I do think these interviews are more in depth and they're more informative than the kind of brief ones that you get on that original disc. I do want to make point of two early performances that are kind of fun to see. An early Burt Young.
Yeah.
Right.
Has actually a very funny two-part performance in the film.
Yeah, they talk about him too.
And an early Diane Ladd.
Yeah.
In a key
role. That's right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, very good. Now, Two Jakes. We got a little clip from that. This is the sequel to Chinatown that was made under real duress. But here's a little clip from that, and then we'll discuss it.
In this town, I'm a leper with the most fingers.
That's a great line.
I'm actually, obviously, like Godfather 3, you know, it's not going to be comparable to Godfather 1 and 2.
But it's still a good film.
It's still a good film, and you know, the question about Godfather, you know, the comment you can, the defense I always make about Godfather 3, you know, how could it be as good as 1 and 2? And so how could Two Jakes be as good as Chinatown? But I do think Two Jakes is a remarkable film, and it was a pretty brave film to actually come. I remember it came out in August.
August of 1990.
So summer of 90. So we're, you know, entering the 90s. You know, and we're entering the big blockbuster summer. So remember summer 1990?
Yeah, it was a number one movie, a new one every week.
New one every week. And this was the summer that Julia Roberts became a star. So
that's right.
This is when, you know, Flatliners.
That's right. It came out. Well, yeah, Flatliners was.
Yeah, Flatliners and.
Darkman.
Darkman.
Okay, let's talk about Two Jakes.
Okay, but Two Jakes, so it was kind of brave. It was kind of a folly that Two Jakes got released in the midst of all of that, and it was doomed pretty much from the beginning, but it was so classical and it's retro in its style that it is a great adult entertainment. And for the five people who were fans of Tony Richardson's The Border, it was great to see Nicholson and Keitel again.
Yeah, oh totally.
Yeah, and you get some great other great performances. Who is it? David Keith.
David Keith is good. Madeline Stowe.
Early Madeline Stowe.
And Tracy Walter.
Tracy Walter.
And what's the name? Robert. What's it? Robert. Who else?
Robert Forster.
Robert
Foxworth.
Richard Farnsworth.
Richard Farnsworth.
Perry Lopez comes back from the.
May I ask a question, Aaron?
Yeah.
Do you think? All right, I think Keitel is brilliant as Jake Berman. Do you think Robert Evans would have been better as they originally planned?
I don't think so. Because
you think it would have been more spectacle?
I must say this. Obviously, Keitel is a much better actor than Robert Evans.
Oh, that goes without saying.
But I must say there's a small, small part of me that wouldn't mind have seen, you know, at least let me see the rehearsal footage
right.
of Nicholson and Evans, and just let me see how that would have played out. It probably would have been, it obviously would have, the scenes that they had would have had a whole different tone.
History. I mean, that history would have been right there.
Yeah.
So, but it's one of these, it's hard to be friends in business, and I'm sure it was hard for Nicholson it was Robert Towne who let Robert Evans go. You know, he pulled out as a director.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want to bother with Evans, but the undercurrent, if you read Peter Biskin's book, Easy Rider, Raging Bulls,
right.
the whole thing is that Robert Towne is just fearful of directing, and so that's why he did it, because Nicholson said, I don't know why he did it early. He could have, you know, Evans wasn't going to be in until 6 weeks into the shoot, and he could have fired him then, and the studio would have backed him, because we have so much footage, we can't do anything. But, you know, Robert Towne is obviously has a hard time mustering up the energy to direct. And so
Robert Towne, I think the falling out between Robert Towne and Nicholson happened on this film. But
yeah.
In terms of Evans and Nicholson, I mean, they're lifelong
friends. Yeah, they're joined at the hip.
That's a bond that won't die.
If we all know the great documentary, The Kids Laid in the Picture, I believe it's Nicholson that goes to Morocco or someplace to beg for Robert Evans' old house. You know, you got to give this guy his house back.
Yeah, that's right.
mean,
yeah, he's a great treasured friend for them. So the quality of the two Jakes, obviously it's no Chinatown, everyone can agree, but it stands on its own. I mean,
yeah.
It deserves to be seen, and it's been forgotten about widely amongst people that aren't.
It's a great-looking film. Vilmos Zsigmond did Hammerman.
I like it. I have no complaints.
And Nicholson, unfortunately, because he's so idiosyncratic, he didn't get to direct more than I think he should have. I mean, Two Jakes is a great piece of directing. Drive, he said, was very...
those are all...
Going.
Yeah, he does some very inventive stuff in this one. So this one deals not with... The first one dealt with water. This is real estate.
Right. If I remember correctly, the third in the trilogy was going to be about...
Air.
And so that would have been, I guess, because of all the pollution that's gone on in... California,
and that follows Jake Geddes as he goes green, right?
Yeah,
drives a Prius, and
and that would have been in the '50s. And I must say, I know politics is everything, you know, studio politics, but it'd be nice if someone was willing to, like, okay, look, I'll give you the 15, you know, if you're willing to cut your salary, I'll give you 15, 20 million tops.
I agree.
If you want to go do your film and. I will eat the loss.
I would actually welcome, even though they can't do it because there's a falling out, if you watch Robert Towns eat the Ask the Dust, I would welcome him to come back. I mean, because I don't think Ask the Dust was as bad as everyone made it out to be, but I think he has a feel for old Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And I would welcome him. Who I'd really welcome back is Roman Polanski, because they can shoot it in South Africa, obviously, and... Mm-hmm.
Well, they can do like De Palma did with Black Dahlia. Shoot it like in, you know, Prague.
I mean, I would really welcome a third one. It is. Yeah, you know, I know it's not. It's not. You know, amongst we like the story, and we, you know, we're fans of the second one. But I would love to see a third one.
Well, I would love to see because while I actually do like the ending of the Two Jakes, Nicholson points out in the documentary in the one featurette, Jack on Jakes. On this Two Jakes documentary, he goes, it was meant to be the middle, and so therefore it was going to be a little, some loose ends at the end.
Right.
It has kind of a open-ended ending, and this third film was going to conclude everything, and it was going to end in the 50s.
Okay. So the second film, tell me about the disc, the extras on it.
Well, it's a pretty good transfer. Because the soft, the very mood lighting of Vilmos Zsigmond is just pretty delicate, and so it's a very good transfer and very muted tone, a lot of browns and dust golds, and it just looks remarkable.
Yeah.
And like I said, there's only one featurette on this, and obviously from the looks of it, it was filmed while they filmed the Chinatown featurette, and this one is just Nicholson.
What's the link on it?
Called Jack on Jakes, and he's very open about it. He even says, he goes, you know, Bob's script, you know, He goes, the film is very elliptical. He goes, and I'm very elliptical, and I like that. And he goes, I understand that was going to be kind of limiting commercially. And he goes, I know Bob wanted a couple of more flashbacks to kind of, so you could connect the dots a little easier. He goes, but that probably would have been actually very good and would have worked. He goes, but I didn't mind not having those. And so Nicholson is very open. As open as Nicholson can be, that he admits that the film was limiting and that he almost pretty much says, he goes, I knew the film was pretty much doomed. He goes, but I like doing it, and it probably could have been more commercial if we had added a little more clues so you could really do the connecting. He goes, but as it is, I think the film works on its own, and I do agree. I do wish more people would try to take a look at it. Maybe... I think it's smart, you know, smart that Paramount Home Video is releasing both of them at the same on the same day, so people might just instinctively or compulsively pick them both up. Because I will say, you cannot watch Two Jakes without having seen Chinatown.
It would be impossible to follow. I think
it was. I remember when I went to a, of all things, in Summer of Night, I went to a radio sponsored sneak preview. Of the Two Jakes. Who'd ever thought a rock station would be promoting the Two Jakes? But it was a radio-sponsored sneak, and it's just as a goof, like the 2 weeks earlier, I had rented Chinatown. So I was probably, me, my sister, and my mother were probably the only three or four people in the theater who were able to follow along.
I was afraid of that.
Yeah, everyone else was kind of like, huh?
They were expecting the Joker.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Nicholson had just come off of...
they were expecting the Joker, weren't
yeah.
they?
They were expecting, you know, he just come off of Batman, so they were probably expecting that. And
So you would recommend this disc?
Oh, yeah, Two Jakes is... I recommend Two Jakes fully. I think it's a remarkable film.
Okay. Now we have 15 minutes. And also, anyone that wants to call in tonight, our number here is 718-508-9477. If you want to discuss any of these DVD releases we're talking about tonight, if you want to share your thoughts on Lions for Lambs, or you want to share your thoughts on Poltergeist, which we covered in the first half hour of the show, feel free to call in.
Or if you
want to
berate Jerry, please call in.
Let's not do that.
Yeah, let's not do that.
So we're going to cover Ratatouille now.
Yeah, Ratatouille, that on Pixar DVD. It's a good DVD. I'm a little stunned. It's kind of I am assuming that we will be getting a more elaborate version in probably a year from now or sometime down the road, because this is only a single disc and not even a Brad Bird commentary.
Really?
Oh my.
You know, or no real big, you know, not even a making of documentary. So I am assuming that somewhere down the line we're going to get a Ratatouille, you know, the 9-course meal edition type of deal.
What about the Blu-ray DVD version?
I haven't heard. I'm sure they have a couple of more, dining tutorials or, you know, featurettes on kind of the food, but nothing I've read says, you know, commentary or documentary.
Oh, okay.
Like, you know, The Incredibles has or you know, any of the other, or The Iron Giant, you know, when it finally got its special edition. So I'm assuming Ratatouille will get its due at some point. Probably after the Oscars when it wins Best Animated Film.
But for now, it's a good transfer, but bare bones.
It's not even a bare bones DVD. What it has on it is actually quite fun. I have it right here. Let's see. It has a couple of here. It does have some deleted scenes. And the fun stuff is an animated short, a new animated short with Rennie and Emil called Your Friend the Rat. And then it has a featurette between Brad Bird and Chef Thomas Keller.
Okay.
And another animated theatrical short film called Lifted. So, you know, so it does have some fun stuff. And, of course, you can't fault Pixar transfers or audio, you know, transfers.
No, they're really made for the
yeah.
HD. So obviously it's going to be good. And obviously, you know, I'm assuming that they put this out now because holidays are coming, and so, you know, it's for Christmas, you know, got to get the kids something to keep them busy.
Right.
So this is what's going to happen.
And Ratatouille was a wildly popular movie.
It was wildly popular.
I think it's a fun film. It's wonderful to look at. It's just, you know, wonderful to look at. I'm a big Patton Oswalt fan, and Peter O'Toole is fun as the critic. But I'm not on the bandwagon that people say that this is a landmark in animation and it's better than The Incredibles. I happen to think The Incredibles is probably the best animated film of the decade.
Right.
Wow.
And both of those are from Brad Bird.
Brad Bird. I think Brad Bird is very talented. I look forward to his next film, obviously.
Right.
But I think the critical praise that was heaped on Ratatouille might have been a little overpraised. I tell you, my theory is that this was Pixar, and I think people... You know, Cars was last year, and Cars is actually a very remarkable film, but for some reason it got a little of this, and it was a big hit, obviously, you know, $200 million, which is what they all love, but for some reason there were some pockets of people that said, it's too long, or it's, you know, it's a little more sophisticated, you know. Basically,
there's nothing sophisticated about Cars.
Basically it meant, you know, their kid was squirming. Through the film.
That's a good point.
Their kid was squirming, therefore the film must be bad. Heaven forbid your kid is just not sophisticated. But somehow, so Pixar got a bit of a drubbing from that. And remember, Cars was not a Brad Bird film. So Brad Bird's next film comes out also under the Pixar name. And since it was moved faster and was, some thought it had more of a life to it than Cars, and that, and obviously I think the kids weren't squirming. This automatically equated, well, Ratatouille is a much better film,
right,
and is a great film. I don't think so. I actually thought Cars was better than Ratatouille. Cars is actually is very sly and very funny and very witty.
Let's play a little sound clip of Brad Bird talking about Ratatouille, and we'll follow that with a little clip from the actual film, and then we'll get your whether or not you recommend it or not. So here you go.
It's an absurd, wonderful, far-fetched premise, the idea of a rat wanting to enter gourmet cooking.
Wow.
Well, right there, I mean, if that doesn't sell the film,
I
don't know what will.
Here's a clip from the movie.
I need this job. I don't know how to cook, and now I'm actually talking to a rat as if you... Did you not? You understand me?
Holy shit. Wait a second. Aaron, were you in that movie? That's your fucking voice.
Jerry.
Oh, my God. Dude, we have a celebrity on our show.
We're talking about a children's movie.
God, come on. I'm just trying to liven it up. I'm sorry, okay?
I don't think
there are that many kids listening to the show right now.
All right, so Aaron, do you recommend or not?
I had a lot of fun making the movie.
That's awesome. I want your autograph, and I'm going to send you a piece of paper. You can sign it.
I'll sign a Domino's box.
Okay, cool.
No, obviously I recommend Ratatouille. It is a good film. It's a good family film. This is a good DVD. Obviously, I think parents are going to buy it for the kids to keep them busy during the holidays. If you're an adult and you're a Ratatouille fan, I would probably, you might want it, but I would probably wait till... I'm assuming after the Oscars we're going to get the 9-course special edition,
right,
which will probably have all these features and a bunch more.
By the way, we just had a comment in the chat room that there are currently 4 small children listening to our show.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Sorry, kids.
Sorry, kids. I didn't mean that.
But like I said, Ratatouille is a good film. I don't think it's the masterpiece that people are putting it out to be. Unfortunately, I think it's going to probably win Best Animated Feature from every critics group and probably the Oscars.
Do you really think that?
It has such critical unanimous praise.
What about the French film, Persepolis, based on the Iranian graphic novel?
I'm sure there'll be a couple of critics groups that might go that way.
I'm just wanted to throw that out there.
I don't think the Academy is going to go for it.
No, I don't think so either.
I think The Simpsons was a little more sophisticated, and actually, I think B Movie is underrated.
Right.
Yeah, those are. Yeah, you got to throw all those in there. That's right.
Well, just to call it a B movie, it's underrating it.
Yeah.
I will say, and we'll talk about this later. I am curious to see if Beowulf is going to be considered an animated film.
Yeah.
And if so, then that
could
be.
God, Jamie,
what's the Polar Express?
Gal.
I think the Polar Express was, I just don't think it was nominated at the time. Now
it'll be interesting. Okay, tell us, we have just limited time, so tell us really quick about the Pixar collection that you have, the other...
This DVD is a lot, is more fun, obviously, just because you can see the evolution of just the great talent that is Pixar, and it has 9 shorts. Let me read these to y'all. Some of these, obviously, The Adventures of Andre and Wally B., Luxo Jr., Red Dream, Tin Toy, Knick Knack, which is a good one, Jerry's Game, For the Birds, Mike's New Car, which was a lot of fun. That was in conjunction of Monsters, Inc., Bonding, another great one, Jack-Jack Attack, The Incredibles, One Man Band, it's a great one.
That's a good one, yeah.
Mater and the Mater and the Ghost Light, and Lifted, which is also on the Ratatouille DVD. So and it has some behind the scenes and some commentaries on these shorts. And this is Volume 1, so we'll be getting more Pixar shorts. And this is very smart of them. I mean, Disney has done a lot of great things in the past couple of years with DVDs with their Walt Disney treasures, you know, Wave 1 and 2, and I think they're coming up on Wave 7. And so I'm glad Pixar is starting from the ground up. So they've rounded up their 9 shorts, and they're pretty spectacular. And some of these have obviously been nominated and or won for the Best Animated Short. And so it's good to have them in one place. I get the feeling this might appeal more to older animation fans, to collectors, than it will to small kids.
Right. Now, is that already out now?
That is out. It was a day and date with the Ratatouille DVD.
Which was last Tuesday.
Right.
And Two Jakes in Chinatown are this coming Tuesday.
Yes, they are out also.
Oh, they're already out, too.
They're already out. They're on the 6th.
Okay.
Stuff was on this past Tuesday. So all this.
Oh,
stuff
okay.
Is,
so you recommend all of these?
I recommend all these. Go to your nearest Costco or Walmart if you want a little adventure in your life, and you'll get them.
Okay. A couple of notes before we get off the air tonight. I think Mr. Grace misspoke just a little bit in our earlier interview because he was discussing the plans for Poltergeist 4. And I believe he said that...
He said Poltergeist 3.
Yeah. And
I didn't want to correct him, though. I thought that would have been...
I think he knows Poltergeist 3. I just think he doesn't acknowledge it.
Yeah.
Aaron. Good point.
He was offered Poltergeist 3, I read, and he turned it down. He just thought it was time, you know, to move on, and there wasn't anything left to mine in Poltergeist 3, which any fan of the Poltergeist films that have seen 3, I think, would probably agree.
Yeah.
But it would be the third Poltergeist film for him, though.
That's true.
But it's, in fact, Poltergeist 4, of which he said, you know, basically a rumor that isn't going anywhere, that there's
and
no status on it.
What I understand, it's not even a 4, it's called Poltergeist in the Shadows.
In the Shadows, right.
There's no number.
And maybe that's probably where it's remaining.
That's where it will stay for a long time.
Also, I missed something last show with Brian De Palma. I forgot to mention, you know, we had our tribute show for De Palma, and our first guest was so generous in calling all the way from Israel. Eyal Peretz, and his new book on De Palma is out now. It's called Becoming Visionary, Brian De Palma's Cinematic Education of the Senses. And I've read it, and it's basically one of the most unique perspectives on De Palma's work that you'll ever find. It's very challenging. It challenges what you think of, how much you perceive in the images that De Palma creates. But it's a very in-depth. It's not.
He was
any,
a great guest.
Yeah.
It challenges just the process of reading.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, there you go, folks.
Readers can decode that all in any way they want to.
Yes, take it however you think it means.
Yeah. Let's play Aaron's clip again from Ratatouille.
No, let's not.
Here you go. Here's Aaron.
I need this job. I don't know how to cook, and now I'm actually talking to a rat as if you... Did you not? You understand me?
You should be really, really proud of that.
Hey, that was take 20.
Take 20? Wow, man, all right.
Wow. And I think we've heard the first 19 takes tonight.
Yeah, and I just want to... I was checking the chat room. I just want to thank an old friend of mine, Neo, for being in there. Thank you.
Yeah. I have been going back and forth.
He is the chosen one.
Yeah.
Mm.
With
great.
Neo.
She's wonderful.
It's great. Thanks, everyone, for listening tonight. Thank you, guys, for participating. Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, Mark Isham, Oscar-nominated composer, worked a lot with Robert Redford, composed Lions for Lambs, Reservation Road, and The Valley of Elah.
All very good scores.
A River Runs Through It is one of them that he's really famous for. It'll be an exciting discussion, so join us on Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern. That's it for us, guys.
All right, good night, and thanks for listening.
Good night.
You guys.